We've got an important guest here. I have a director for nuclear security, and it's Terry Lodge, who worked very hard on New START. So I'm going to ask Terry to introduce Anita.
With pleasure. I'll give you a brief bit about her resume, but then I'll tell you what I really think. Anita is the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Nuclear and Strategic Policy for the Bureau of Arms Control and Verification and Compliance. She serves as the Director of Policy and Regional Affairs in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, that's EUR for those who are familiar with the State Department. And she was the Director for Arms Control and Non-Cooperation at the National Security Council from 2009 to 2011. She's now the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Bureau of Arms Control, Verification, and Compliance. And she has been at the center of arms control, non-proliferation, defense, and national security policy for an entire career of 33 years, both at the state and at the White House. She is an extraordinary human being, an extraordinary worker, and an extraordinary leader, and I hope you'll welcome her today. Anita.
Here we
This I better not disappoint. thank you very much, Terry. Thank you, Steve. That was a very nice introduction, and I'm very pleased to be here today. And I see there are many other experts, dare I say, far more expert and have just as much, if not more, experience than I do. And I see Ed Levine and Fred Thielman, Steve Pfeiffer. But thank you very much. Let me start with some prepared remarks. You may see, they're prepared, but the real interesting part of all of this is always the questions and answers, and I look forward to hearing what your thoughts and reactions are to this. As Terry said, we've been at this with the Obama administration for a little more than 4 years now, but we still have a lot, and we've made some progress, but we still have a long way to go, and hopefully we can get a lot further in the remainder of the years. So, let me start by saying I will focus my remarks on three main areas. This is the whole nuclear priority. So they are pursuing a step-by-step approach to nuclear disarmament, dealing with North Korea and Iran, and securing vulnerable nuclear materials. At the outside, again, another 3 points here, just in terms of where we are in the record. First, the United States remains and is committed to seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons. The president has certainly made this clear, and remains the president's goal. However, it's also clear that the goal of a world free of nuclear weapons will not be reached quickly. As the president said, probably not in his lifetime. It will take patience, persistence, and it must be done in a step-by-step manner. You'll hear me say this, and you've probably heard many others say this before, but this is the way it works best. Second, the U.S. has been reducing its inventory of nuclear weapons for more than four decades now. By September 2009, the U.S. nuclear stockpile was reduced by 84%, which is approximately 5,000 nuclear warheads from the peak of what was approximately 31,000 nuclear warheads in 1967. During this period, the United States unilaterally reduced its non-strategic nuclear warheads by 90%. Thirdly, the practical step-by-step approach to nuclear disarmament that President Obama laid out in April of 2009 in Prague and reaffirmed during the nuclear security summits in Washington in 2010 and then in Seoul in 2012 has really proven, again, to be the most effective means to increase stability, reduce nuclear dangers, and fulfill our commitments under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. So let me move away from the long history and highlight some of the efforts that we now have underway. I have to start with New START, since I was certainly that was front and center. Terry was front and center. And many of you have certainly been involved in that. The New START treaty between the U.S. and Russia is now in its third year of implementation. When the central limits of the treaty are reached in 2018, the strategic nuclear forces of both the U.S. and Russia will reach their lowest levels since the 1950s. The rigorous and extensive verification provisions of New START testify to the importance of transparency, effective verification, and provide predictability and stability in international relations. Both sides, and I emphasize this, both sides, U.S. and Russia, agree that the treaty implementation is proceeding smoothly in a, as a cliche, business-like and professional manner. It sounds very Soviet, indeed. I'm sure many of our colleagues will agree. But I have to say, I mean, having worked under, working with START before and the implementation of the START agreement, especially in Embassy Moscow, where I served for many years, going forward with the same demarches time and time again for many years, in comparison, we've done much, much better with the new START treaty. Things are really being, we are working together to solve problems, not to create more problems. Taken together, the parties have now conducted 78 inspections of new START facilities since the treaty entered into force in February of 2011. Besides, the nuclear risk reduction centers have exchanged more than 3,700 notifications regarding the movements, location, and status of strategic offensive arms subject to the treaty. The U.S. and Russia have now met 5 times in the Bilateral Consultative Commission. The most recent meeting was last month in February, and have begun to exchange telemetry information on the launches of ICBMs and SLBMs. As the administration's 2010 nuclear posture review made clear, the U.S. is determined to better align its nuclear policies and postures with the most urgent priorities of preventing nuclear terrorism and nuclear proliferation. Dealing with those challenges does require the massive does not require the massive nuclear arsenals that were accumulated during the Cold War. We are reducing the role of nuclear weapons in our national security strategy, as well as further reducing our nuclear stockpile. With regard to modernization, the Nuclear Posture Review ruled out the development of new U.S. nuclear warheads and new missions and capabilities for existing warheads. When the President signed the New START Treaty in Prague in 2010, he stressed his intention to pursue further reductions in strategic, non-strategic, deployed and non-deployed nuclear weapons. And then in January of this year, in the State of the Union, the President reiterated his commitment to further reductions in nuclear arsenals of the U.S. and Russia. Clearly, this is remains our top priority, but as always, it's easier said than done. Through the Bilateral Presidential Commission's Arms Control and International Security Working Group, the administration has begun a dialogue with Russia regarding nuclear weapons, their effect on stability and transparency regarding them. Many of you may have seen just in the last couple of days, Secretary Hagel and his counterpart, his Russian counterpart, Minister Shoigu, have just agreed that we will reactivate our discussions with the MOD-DOD lead, so we're hopeful that that will happen soon. I also might mention today, I think it was announced or it may have been last night, that Tom Donilon, our national security advisor, will go to Moscow on April 15th. Russians, I believe, announced it also. Let me comment on the P5 process as well. So meanwhile, the 5 NPT nuclear weapon states, or P5, are pursuing a substantive and focused agenda related to commitments under the 2010 NPT Review Conference Action Plan. This P5 process complements the work of other multilateral fora by helping to ensure the nuclear weapon states have regular, candid discussions among themselves on nuclear issues. The U.S. will participate in April in the 4th P5 conference, and this one is hosted by Russia and will take place in Geneva. Continued U.S. engagement with other P5 countries, especially Russia and China, on sensitive issues such as arms control and nonproliferation, builds trust, encourages transparency, demonstrates U.S. leadership, and is a long-term investment that creates a stronger foundation for future discussions on nuclear weapons issues. Such engagement leaves the P5 better positioned to make progress on the 2010 NPT Action Plan. We continue to implement the Action Plan across all 3 pillars of the NPT: disarmament, nonproliferation, and the peaceful uses of nuclear energy. While much remains to be accomplished, the P5 are working together collegially and productively. Of particular note is China's leadership in chairing a P5 working group to develop a glossary on glossary of key nuclear terms, which aims to increase mutual understanding and facilitate further P5 discussions on related matters. This is, really was a step forward when China agreed to take the lead in this effort. Mutual cooperation of this kind is a positive step that can lead to deeper engagement on nuclear weapons issues and greater mutual confidence. The grand bargains of the NPT were nuclear weapon states pursue disarmament, non-nuclear weapon states abstain from the pursuit of nuclear weapons, and all countries are able to assess or access the benefits of peaceful nuclear energy, sets an enduring standard that is relevant today as it was in the treaty's inception. Let me talk a little bit about the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty. This is perhaps not a great news story, but we keep trying. We continue to work with the P5 and other relevant countries to launch negotiations on a Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty. The next multilateral, this is the next multilateral nuclear disarmament step. It is endorsed by all NPT states parties in the 2010 NPT Action Plan and a central tenet of the President's Prague vision of a world without nuclear weapons. The U.S. shares the goals of a non-discriminatory treaty that halts the production of fissile material for use in nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices, and one that is internationally verifiable. An FMCT would be an important international achievement, both for non-proliferation and disarmament. It would effectively cap fissile materials available for use in nuclear weapons. There are no technical or conceptual obstacles to the commencement of FMCT negotiations, but of course there are political obstacles. We deeply regret that the Geneva Conference on Disarmament has to date been blocked on moving forward on this issue. The U.S. continues to prefer that FMCT be dealt with in the Conference on Disarmament, which is a well-established venue for negotiations that includes every major nuclear-capable state, and the organization operates by consensus, which is also very important. We are also using every available opportunity in the context of the Conference of Disarmament to make progress toward FMCT negotiations, including serious consultations among states that would be directly affected by an FMCT. We continue to be hopeful that the UN, or we are hopeful that the UN Group of Governmental Experts, or a GGE, that was agreed to last fall, to be established by the UN General Assembly, will also help foster negotiations in the CD. We move on to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. I know that's one of great interest to all of you,
always,
and to me. The ratification and entry into force of the CTBT also remains a priority for the Obama administration. We are convinced that national security of the U.S. will be enhanced when the CTBT enters into force. The 2010 Nuclear Posture Review made clear that ratification of CTBT is central to leading other nuclear weapon states toward a world of diminished reliance on nuclear weapons, reduced nuclear competition, and eventual nuclear disarmament. Now, we clearly recognize that U.S. ratification of the CTBT will not be easy. The key issues related to this treaty are very technical in nature, and we want people to understand the rationale behind it. There is no set time frame to pursue formal consideration by the Senate at this point, but we are patiently and persistently engaged in an ongoing information exchange with members of the U.S. Senate and their staff to lay the groundwork for a successful ratification effort. While we pursue ratification at home in the U.S., the administration continues to call and has been calling on the remaining Annex II states to join us in moving forward toward ratification. I know there are many countries that are waiting for the U.S. to move forward, but there really, I mean, our point is there really is no reason to wait for us. North Korea and dealing with North Korea and Iran. Here's obviously a key topic, especially given the headlines in the past couple of days. Despite our past nuclear nonproliferation and disarmament successes, there are very pressing challenges around us on the horizon. Most critically, we have grave concerns about the actions of North Korea and Iran. Their actions threaten international security, undermine confidence in the nonproliferation regime, and stand directly in the way of our shared disarmament goals. Let me be very clear, the U.S. and the international community do not and will not accept North Korea as a nuclear-armed state, nor will we stand by it while it seeks to develop a nuclear-armed missile that can target the United States. At the same time, the international community has made clear that there will be consequences for North Korea's violations of its international obligations. As the UN Security Council demonstrated again earlier this month, in unanimously adopting UNSC Resolution 2094 in response to North Korea's recent provocative nuclear test. North Korea's February 12th nuclear test, following on the heels of the December 12th launch, was a highly provocative act that violates North Korea's obligations under numerous UNSC resolutions, contravenes its commitments under the September 2005 joint statement of the six-party talks, and increases the risk of proliferation. The U.S. is firmly committed to the defense of our homeland and also of our allies, in particular the Republic of Korea and Japan, and to the maintenance of regional peace and stability. We remain committed to authentic and credible negotiations to implement the September 2005 joint statement of the six-party talks and to bring North Korea into compliance with its international obligations through irreversible steps leading to denuclearization. However, the U.S. will not reward bad behavior. The onus is on North Korea to take meaningful actions toward denuclearization and refrain from further provocations. The U.S. will continue to work with allies and partners to tighten national and international sanctions to further impede North Korea's nuclear and missile and to further impede North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. Moving on to Iran. In the meantime, Iran remains in violation of its international nuclear obligations, including its safeguard agreements with the IAEA, the NPT, and relevant resolutions of the UN Security Council and the IAEA Board of Governors. The U.S., along with the international community, remains gravely concerned about the Iranian nuclear program. While we have repeatedly said we do not dispute Iran's right to a peaceful nuclear program, multiple UNSC resolutions require Iran to suspend its proliferation-sensitive nuclear activities, including enrichment. Iran can address international concerns by meeting the suspension requirement and by finally granting IAEA safeguards and inspectors the cooperation they need to reestablish the required verification assurances. The U.S. remains committed to the dual-track approach of engagement and pressure on Iran in pursuit of diplomatic resolution to Iran's nuclear program. The U.S. is determined to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon. There is still a window to resolve this issue diplomatically, but that window will not remain open indefinitely. International sanctions have been instrumental in bringing Iran back to the negotiating table, but it remains to be seen whether the regime has decided to engage seriously on a diplomatic resolution of the nuclear issue. So it's important to continue to work towards a diplomatic resolution that addresses the international community's concerns about Iran's nuclear program. The P5+1 remain united and prepared to make progress. Again, the onus remains with Iran if it wants to pursue a path to end its isolation. And then let me conclude by talking about securing vulnerable nuclear materials. In terms of nuclear security, the Obama administration has worked very hard with partners around the world to secure vulnerable nuclear materials and keep them out of terrorists' hands. I believe we can all agree that the nuclear security summits in Washington in 2010 and then in Seoul in 2012 have focused unprecedented high-level attention on the need to keep the world safe from the threat of nuclear terrorism. We look forward to the Netherlands, who will host the next summit in March of 2014. The Bureau of International Security and Nonproliferation State is leading Bureau efforts within the Department for addressing nuclear security and plays a key role in U.S. efforts to secure vulnerable nuclear materials. We are active in programs and diplomacy aimed at minimizing the use of highly enriched uranium in civil applications, strengthening and encouraging adherence to nuclear security conventions, norms and guidelines, preventing trafficking in nuclear materials, developing centers of excellence for exchanging best practices in nuclear security, and for preventing nuclear terrorism. The communiques resulting from the 2010 and 2012 nuclear security summits advance these key nuclear security goals. The State Department continues to work with other U.S. agencies and with countless partner countries and international organizations and initiatives to achieve the objectives of the four-year nuclear material lockdown effort, as first set forth by President Obama in his 2009 Prague speech. In addition, dozens of national and multilateral commitments and accomplishments on enhancing nuclear security were announced at the nuclear security summits. To name just a few, Mexico and Ukraine have now voluntarily removed all of their HEU, and Belgium and the Netherlands pledged to convert their medical isotope production industries from HEU to low-enriched uranium by 2015. Our overarching goal for the four-year effort is to remove, consolidate, or eliminate as much weapon-usable nuclear material as practicable and ensure that all remaining sites at a minimum meet IAEA security guidelines. So, closing, we recognize that there is still much work to be done. Nuclear material continues to be stored without adequate protection, at risk of exploitation by terrorists and criminal gangs that have expressed interest in acquiring it. The focused portion of a four-year nuclear material lockdown will end in 2013, but nuclear security will remain an enduring responsibility of all nations as long as such materials exist. Although efforts to lock down nuclear and radioactive materials worldwide have significantly increased security, I would add that the seizures of weapons-usable nuclear material in Georgia in 2010 and in Moldova in 2011 suggest that dangerous nuclear and radioactive materials may currently remain available on the black market and must be located and secured. So through the Nuclear Security Summit process and related engagements, the State Department and other U.S. agencies are working to strengthen international counter nuclear smuggling capabilities or capacities, to investigate smuggling networks, and to recover black market nuclear materials. These efforts include increased training for law enforcement and other investigators, training on radiation detection systems and nuclear forensics, and legal training to prosecute nuclear smugglers. Without question, the nuclear security will remain an enduring responsibility of us all. So let me finally conclude by acknowledging that, as I started out at the beginning, that we have much work ahead of us, but also that we look forward to continuing a dialogue with you as we move forward. Let me also emphasize a commitment to a world without nuclear weapons that the U.S. shares with like-minded states and colleagues in civil society, and also reaffirm our deep commitment to enduring the nearly 68-year record of non-use of nuclear weapons is extended forever. Thank you very much for your attention. I look forward to your questions.
Anita, thank you. Some may know I'm a former artillery officer, and that means I lend dignity to what would otherwise be a vulgar brawl. So I'm gonna lay out some ground rules here, and if you don't mind, I'll moderate
Please.
For a little bit. First off, this is on the record. We are taping it. We'll have it up on our website this afternoon. We have a hashtag here, and we are Twittering it simultaneously as well. On the Q&A, we don't have a roving mic, although I have one up here. So what I will pick who's going to ask the question. If you could stand, identify yourself and your affiliation, speak loudly, hopefully offer a short question so we can get as many in as possible. And with that, I'm going to offer the first opportunity to Terry Lodge. Terry?
Thank you, Steve. Anita, can you tell us a little bit about the progress in reestablishing an umbrella agreement to support non-Luger and other activities?
Did not comment on that, but there you go.
Fine.
Yes, the CTR, the Cooperative Threat Reduction Agreement. As many of you may know, the Russians last summer said that they were, first of all, it expires in June of this year, 2013. And we've been working since last summer to try to come up with a follow-on. And this acting Undersecretary Rose Gaudemuller has been leading the efforts. She just met with her counterpart, the Deputy Foreign Minister Rybkov, I'm losing track of time, the week before last. And I think many of you may have seen in the Russian press is very positive about a follow-on agreement of some sort. It's not going to be the same agreement that we had before, but I think we are, there's clearly willingness by the Russian side to do this, and very much on our part. I think we have a good good path ahead of us and look forward to concluding an agreement soon. Thank you.
Thanks. Yes, ma'am.
Rachel Oswald, Global Security Newswire. I have a two-parter, but it'll be brief. Mm-hmm. So the Obama administration has said it's its preference for a new legally binding arms control treaty with Russia that would go below New START, but a number of Republicans in the Senate have said they oppose cuts beyond New START. Given that, you know, there's history of both Republican and Democratic presidents using their executive authority to unilaterally reduce the U.S. stockpile, and sometimes Russia has reciprocated, is the Obama administration at this time contemplating using its executive authority to make unilateral cuts? And the second part of that is the GOP has already said they would oppose any executive action on this. Given that this would certainly sour the chance of getting enough Republican votes to pass CTBT, how is the Obama administration weighing these things?
Okay, very carefully. Thank you, yes. No, there's certainly no secret that this is not an easy thing. As I mentioned at the outset, you know, the president has made very clear that he thinks that we need another bilateral arms control agreement. The Russians, for their part, have said that they were more inclined to continue or to actually move or continue implementation of or have a better track record of implementing the New START agreement. They also have some issues with our missile defense policies, you know. And they also have talked about the next arms control agreement needs to be not bilateral, or would be better that it would involve all nuclear powers. So we've got lots of things going here. As I mentioned, we have had ongoing discussions on strategic stability and other issues to lay the groundwork, or try to begin to lay the groundwork with the Russians. Separately, but obviously very much connected, is the NPR follow-on study, the famous 90-day study that has taken a little bit longer than 90 days. But this is not the only administration in which it's taken longer than 90 days. So that will be key when that is rolled out, and the decision there, that will be key in however we move forward. So right now we're in a process of, the term is doing our homework and looking at various options. So in terms of unilateral reductions, I mean, we are looking at all options, but that's, there is nothing at this point.
Yes, sir.
Jeffrey Lynn from Senator Angus Kane's office. I was wondering, given the, you mentioned the Russian concern about making further nuclear reductions sort of multilateral globally, especially on the P5, how you would view, say, China, Britain, and France's roles in nuclear, reducing their nuclear weapons, especially given that the Chinese are working on a missile defense system and the French, I believe, are building new ballistic missile submarines.
Now, as I said, yes, the Russians are very interested in having all of the nuclear weapon states participate, but that's not, it's clearly not, we're not at that point yet. And we are working through this P5 effort. I mean, this, as I mentioned, the work is ongoing, and it, really the best part about the P5 effort is the ongoing discussion and engagement. I mean, it's an opportunity where we can discuss these issues with France, with all of the P5. Most specifically with also China. As I mentioned, I think it is positive. There are small steps. I mean, the fact that China is leading the effort in this glossary effort, it is important. I've sat in on some of these discussions, and it really is, I think we have a very good synergy. Participants have cooperated. So we're working on it.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Maggie Kozel. I'm on leave from the Sam Nunn School of International Affairs at Georgia Tech. And you mentioned strategic stability. So I'm curious, and this may be more of a ponderous question. As we are looking at reducing the number of nuclear weapons, there are a lot of really smart people who are thinking about the impact on strategic stability. Mm-hmm. Is anyone looking at how that links with, at the same time, we're looking at reducing the number of conventional forces, particularly the ground troops? And so is anyone looking at how those two factors,
you've got conventional and your nuclear deterrence might have second, third order consequences within each other.
Certainly, I mean, there's certainly an effect. So yes, we're looking at the whole question, sure. But that's a very good point. It really doesn't come up very often, certainly in discussions, but yes, we are certainly looking at that.
Yes, sir.
Hey, Greg.
Greg Thiel, the Arms Control Association. Anita, I wanted to ask you about a naval nuclear reactor question. And this gets at a loophole in the nuclear non-proliferation treaty by which countries can enrich uranium to weapons-grade level for the purposes of a nuclear-powered reactor in a submarine. That's what the United States does. Mm-hmm. This didn't seem like a big problem in the Cold War era, but today when countries like Iran and Brazil are talking about building nuclear-powered submarines, we have non-proliferation worries about highly enriched uranium. Is this something that's gotten any attention in the State Department? Any concern about extending NPT coverage of highly enriched uranium prohibitions?
It has. There is a Department of Defense is certainly very concerned about that. We've had some discussions. It's something that we're very much aware of, but nothing that we're actively working on right now.
Yes, sir.
Edward Levine, formerly with the staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. You have a year left until the next Nuclear Security Summit. What further progress do you think is realistically possible to be achieved during that year and in promises that you will collect next March? And are there authorities or funding that you wish you had that would make your life easier in the nuclear security field?
Second part, that's a good question. We actually have 2 years. the review conference is in 2015, so we have a little more time. That said, we hear this and look at this every day and recognize there's not a lot of time between now and 2015 to achieve, to make more progress. I mean, we're having the PrepCom meeting is later, it's next month, it's April, we're still in March. So we're moving forward. As the P5 as a whole is trying to make progress. I mean, we have the New START Treaty. We have, I've mentioned a myriad of things that we're doing to get, the U.S. is doing by itself, but also within the P5. Many of my colleagues, one of the big question is, why not get CTBT ratified? That would be a great achievement, something really great for the NPT review conference. Yes, it would, and that's certainly something that we're looking at. But as I mentioned, I mean, and all of you are aware, the timing here, especially the political timing, is obviously a consideration. But we have the nuclear security summits and the achievements there. We have a good list of things. I guess the question is, there are those who see it as the glass half empty or the glass half full. So we believe we really do have a good record here, and we are going to work as hard as we can to continue to achieve more by the time the review conference comes on board. In terms of additional funding, always, in particular, I'll go back, but I don't have any specific thoughts on specific funding, but that is a very good question.
All the way in the back, standing.
Since we're in the process of talking to the Russians in negotiations, we really can't say anything specifically. I mean, but I can say that both sides want a follow-on agreement. Russians have made it very clear that they wanted some of the projects to continue, but they also want to work more cooperatively with us. They want to work together on cooperative projects. So I think it may take a little different form, both in terms of both the actual legal document or the legal agreement in addition to the project.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I will leave for the rest of the agents at dusk.
Can you speak loud, please?
Yes, sure. Have you got any initial reaction from the Russian side on the changes in missile defense program announced by Secretary Hagan? Do you think that these changes can create opportunities for reaching common ground on this issue? And would you agree that the possibility of reaching, of eliminating the current contradictions on these issues would be necessary for achieving any kind of a new agreement on a further nuclear strategic weapons reductions?
It's a very good question. First of all, yes, we've had numerous Russian official reactions. I think many in the press. I'm not familiar with all of them, but this is exactly one of the issues that Secretary Hagel and Minister Shoigu discussed when they talked earlier this week. So in terms of eliminating the contradictions, well first let me back up. Do we need an agreement or something to eliminate the contradictions before we move on towards actual negotiations or discussions on further nuclear reductions? Russia has made it very clear that we need something here, and we will continue to look at what we can do to address Russian concerns. That said, the United States has been very, very transparent about the program. I was in Brussels last week with my counterpart, Sergei Kosholev, and he made some remarks after NATO meetings. He made them during the NATO meeting, but then also afterwards in the press, which you'll see. I mean, he said that Russia expected the announcement that Secretary Hagel and that was made by the Pentagon, that it was not a surprise. One of my responses was, no, it was not a surprise. I mean, in terms of budgetary transparency, it's all there in black and white. The Russians, you know, everyone can see where we're going with the budget. It was clear that phase four was behind in development, and if you just looked at the budget. So that said, I do think it provides an opening. As I mentioned, Secretary Hagel and Minister Shoigu said that we should resume the discussions that have been suspended since, I believe, 2011 discussions, the military-to-military discussions. So I think we do have an opening of potential for discussions.
Yes, sir, right there. Yep.
Bill Breidrich and I represent SGI, which is a Japanese group. Mm-hmm. First of all, thank you for restating the president's commitment to a nuclear-free world. Two very unrelated questions. A, do you expect the president to restate that publicly on the anniversary in April? And secondly, is the key in Iran moving the enriched material out of Qom, and have the Chinese been cooperative in that effort?
I'll start with the second question. I really can't comment on what the Chinese have or have not done. In terms of, obviously Iran continues to be we're working together, and the Chinese, we are working closely with the Chinese, and they were helpful during the last, during recent discussions and continue to be, but I can't comment specifically. I'm sorry, the first part of your question?
Is the president going
to oh, that was the easy part. Or so. Oh, you're asking me if I think that the president will reiterate.
You guys are
I personally, you'd be surprised. I really don't know, but I think there's a fair chance that he will. Yes, I personally would expect he would.
Sorry, say that again.
I said I personally expect that he would, but I really don't know.
Yes, sir.
Chuck Singer, Nuclear Engineering University of Illinois. The Bilirubin Commission on America's Nuclear Future has recommended the United States participate in a process aimed at multilateral storage of spent nuclear fuel. This has long-term security implications because Neptune could have isotopically pure fissile Neptunium-237 is gradually accumulating in spent fuel around the world. Is this on your radar screen?
Not on my personal radar screen, but I'm certainly happy to take that back and check. But yes, I'm sure it is on the colleagues in the Bureau who work on that specific issue.
Yes, sir.
Stephen Young with Union Concerned Scientists. Question on the difficult case of North Korea. We have the sanctions the U.S. China agreed to on North Korea, which is a positive sign. We have the military exercises with South Korea that have been quite recent. The U.S. flag, the fact that U.S. DC-2 bombers flew over South Korea, recoverable bombers flew over South Korea, have been repeated several times as they did show force with South Korea. Lots of statements from North Korea about threats and bother and all kinds of very scary things, quite frankly. Is there anything going on quietly back channel that's talking to North Korea? Is there anything happening behind the scenes trying to have a dialogue or carrots being offered? Anything positive to talk about other than just threats and sanctions?
The president has made very clear that where we are in this, and certainly the recent comments this week are not positive, to say the least, comments about Hawaii and such. What we have done publicly and will continue to do so is to urge them to heed our warnings and choose the path for peace. In terms of what we're doing behind the scenes, I really can't comment.
Yeah. Dennis Rodman just didn't fix everything over
there.
Right. So we tried, but can't always win them. Another question. If not, I will ask one. Yes, sir.
In fact, I participate in these extended deterrence talks that we work together with the Pentagon and discuss these issues. I am aware of the Korean comments about these South Korean comments recently. I mean, that's certainly not the direction that we are encouraging, but I think it's the most important. It's a reaction, obviously, to the very vitriolic and unhelpful, to say the least, comments by the North Korean side. And we will continue our discussions with the South Koreans and continue to work with them.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Jessica Bufford with the Nuclear Threat Initiative. You mentioned the nuclear security summits, and I was wondering, what are you hoping to get out of the 2014 summit, and what, if anything, comes next?
One step at a time here. Well, I think, as I said, there are a number of working groups and a number of very good initiatives, and they are working right now. We have meetings at least two or three times a year to work toward the next security summit. I think that I don't have any specifics right now, but I'm sure that each of the individual groups will have action plans or things that we hope that they can make progress on for the next security summit. In terms of a follow-on to the summit in The Hague, it's obviously early, but I would think that we would have interest in continuing this because it really has been very successful. I mean, I personally, and I know that Ambassador Pfeiffer is very well aware of the Ukrainian issue. I mean, the issue that the Ukrainians deciding to give up their HEU was a monumental achievement, one that we had worked on for years and years and years. And finally had enough leverage. I think the Nuclear Security Summit and the international collaboration within this group was instrumental in moving toward that.
Well, we already got one Russian question. If nobody else, go ahead. Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. One more on the CTR. Do you have any idea how the sequestration affected this program?
We have the money to continue going on. The sequestration has not specifically affected, to my knowledge, in terms of treaty implementation and international obligations that we have, including CTR, those should move forward.
Yes, sir.
All right. Sorry. I was just wondering how, given that we're Well, what I'm getting at is how are we sort of training the next generation, both the DOD and state, sort of looking and thinking about this, well, post-Cold War nuclear environment, especially given both proliferation, the threat of nuclear terrorism, and the need to eventually do our gradual commitment to global zero.
The next generation. That is something that we have done quite a bit in our Bureau. Undersecretary, Acting Undersecretary Gottemuller in particular, has been in the lead of working on education for the next, educating the next generation of arms controllers, so to speak. And it really is a huge priority. In fact, we actually have someone right now who is working on establishing high school programs and outreach to high school networks. Networks to get young people interested, to explain to them very simply why this is important, what we have done, and to encourage the next generation to continue study in arms control, and not just arms control, but certainly in non-proliferation, and that includes certainly the field of nuclear terrorism, preventing it, that is.
Yeah, hi. Todd Jacobson of Nuclear Weapons and Materials Monitor. Obviously, there's a pretty broad and ambitious agenda for the second term of the Obama administration with CTBT, future arms control reductions with Russia. It seems like some of those goals somewhat step on the toes of each other when you're looking at, with CTBT, you've got to get Republicans to buy into that. With Russia, with the arms control reductions with Russia, you have to make some concessions on missile defense. Is there room to do both of those in the second term of the Obama administration when you've got to have the Senate, you know, supporting both of those? There seems to be a balance that probably has to be struck, and could you talk a little bit about where that balance is and whether, you know, it's feasible to do both of those?
Mm-hmm. Where the balance will be struck, that's really a challenging question here. But in short, I'll start by saying I've worked in this field for more than 30 years, and in order to do so, one has to be an optimist, and I am, for one, an optimist. We will certainly do our best to implement as many of the president's priorities as possible, and he's very serious about this. We had obviously had high hopes for ratification of CTBT earlier. Political, where we are on the Hill is obviously a challenge right now, but that just means that we have to redouble our efforts and work harder toward those goals. But yes, I certainly think there is more than a possibility for doing this, and we certainly continue to do our best.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Akla from Center for Non-Proliferation Studies. I'd actually like to ask you to go into a bit more detail about the nuclear terrorism issue that you keep on raising. I'm looking at it from a bit more academic perspective. If you would think about a profile of a terrorist organization, there seems to be a general agreement that not every terrorist group is motivated to prevent suicide terrorists. So I would probably presume that it's not as simple as any terrorist group that would get access to a material would necessarily commit to such an act. So my question to you is, are there any studies or is there any generalized approach at the administration as to A, what profile of the group we're after, and B, what we presume the drivers for specifically WMD terrorism behavior, what we believe the drivers to be?
Those are very good questions. Now, that unfortunately, that is not my expertise, but I will certainly, I'll go back and look at this. But yes, I mean, there's, as you point out, there are multiple different reasons for the interest here. I would just say that we are certainly, I'm not up on what kind of studies have been done, but I'm sure there is something, we can look into that. But I can assure you, we are certainly working the issue both at the State Department and then also at the NSC. I'm certainly aware of that while I was there.
Yes, ma'am.
So right now, the Pentagon is meeting with senior British defense officials to talk about long-term strategies, which are thought to include the United Kingdom's nuclear weapons, which are, you know, share a lot in common with the United States, and they're both contributing to NATO defense. Given that Britain right now is facing a very serious debate about whether they can afford the Trident renewal, and separately the Scottish independence issue, how much is the possibility that the United Kingdom will not have nuclear weapons or will have a decreased force impact the United States thinking for its own strategic forces in the future?
Well, as you say, we certainly have, we're very close discussions with the UK, and obviously they're an important part of the whole NATO reassurance and of our considerations. In terms of being able to predict where things are going, I think we can certainly, well, we have confidence that certainly in the immediate future that the UK will continue to to have a nuclear capability. But I mean, it's too difficult to predict in the long term.
Anyone else? Going once, going twice. Maggie, I just want to ask, your question, was it, when you talked about using nuclear weapons or the reduction in terms of conventional forces as a substitute for conventional forces?
Well, I'm thinking about this in terms of how are they interacting and who's looking at, because most of the times in which we've had, it's either been one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the thinking now, and is this as part of the larger, you know, whole of government? How is this being thought of? So, I mean, I think this is absolutely a question to go to, the NSS.
Right.
But I would be very much interested. I'm obviously doing some of these things in my own work, but I'd be very happy to follow up.
Yeah, no, it certainly is a consideration. I mean, we certainly do look at the whole picture, and in terms of next steps of where we're going, there are many writings and public writings about this here, about the need, and we really do have an issue with conventional forces. There's a concern certainly on the Russian side, and it's very much part of the thinking. Yeah.
I mean, we're looking at going down to definitely 490 in the 490,000 in the Army, and I mean there's discussion of going even lower than that. The Marines are going down to 172,000 or 182,000. So as you've got these conventional forces, how is that interacting with in a wider milieu question as
By
well?
Conventional forces, you mean you're talking about
ground
troops?
Yeah,
ground troops. Oh,
yeah,
okay. I'm sorry. I was talking about weapons too. But
obviously we don't speak for the administration, but I come from a long time in the Pentagon, and they wax and they wane on the size and strength of the forces. Rarely, if ever, have I heard echoed within the halls of the Pentagon that we need to increase our nuclear forces because our troop strength is decreasing. And the take from the American Security Project's perspective is 1,550 active nuclear weapons is more than enough if you want to use a nuclear weapon. You can't always say you're going to use a nuclear weapon where you're going to use a boots on the ground. So it's kind of apples and oranges in many cases. 1,550 is more than enough for us to have hanging around to compensate for what you might use a nuclear weapon for. But you're not going to use a nuclear weapon to go and defend the embassy in Benghazi or something like that, if you get my point on that. But that's why your question intrigued me. But you do hear it in regards to the Russians. When their conventional forces are decreasing, or maybe their readiness might be, and there's a reticence on their part to maybe not as a deterrent factor. So,
right, yeah, that was certainly the point that's what I was addressing. Also, the other point is you're certainly a greater expert on this than I am, SD, but I think it also depends on who the enemy or what the threat is, and as you know,
bet.
I mean, some countries have a much larger force. We have lean and mean.
You bet.
Some countries have a more effective, smaller force.
One more question. Yes, sir.
Frank Colhorn, the Younger at Embassy. You said in this business you have to be an optimist.
Yes.
So I wonder, what gives you grounds for optimism that in terms of the Russian position, that you can make any headway either on missile defense and or strategic nuclear reductions?
I think one of the reasons is that we have, the U.S. and Russia have a very long and very, very positive relationship in terms of arms control. There are very few countries, we really have a very special relationship in terms of our very long and positive history of working together on nuclear reductions. And I think that in and of itself is a reason that we have a very good chance of future success.
Well, I love to end on an optimistic note. Anita, having you here has just been great for
us at ASP. I hope the audience felt the same way. Your remarks are fabulous. We appreciate your work, and thank you very much for coming.
You're welcome. Thank you.